Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest wishes to remain anonymous, so we're going to call him Mr. X. Mr. X is a former police officer who now investigates everything from 9/11 and the JFK assassination to the deep state psychological campaigns. Mr. X, how are you doing tonight?
Excellent. Thank you for having me on.
I want to thank you for taking the time. Tonight, we're going to be discussing an event that triggered the creation of the term conspiracy theory, the assassination of JFK. In my opinion, it set off a chain of events that's leading us to our Orwellian dystopian future. And you've been doing some amazing research, and you've put together some information and theories that you won't hear anywhere else. Is that right?
That's correct. But just to clarify, a lot of the information that we'll talk about has been out for many, many years. The truth of the matter really was first written about by a guy named Gary Ween back in 1967, I think. And his work has pretty much been buried or scuttled. And the basic principles of his research didn't surface again until Michael Collins Piper came out with Final Judgment, which is really, if you want to understand what happened in the Kennedy assassination, and I'm not talking in Dealey Plaza, I'm talking the big picture. Who gave the order? How it was facilitated, who were the actual players involved that basically led to the shooting of President Kennedy, that has all been covered in Final Judgment. A lot of the work that I've done, thankfully, because we live in 2019, there is so much information available now that the truth is out there. The identities of the actual shooters, and including the Grassy Knoll shooter, is out there. But it takes a lot of research and cross-referencing documents because the important documents have all been suppressed. And when I say suppressed, I don't mean that they are gone. I mean that they're hidden in places that they shouldn't be. A lot of times if you go and you look at some of the miscellaneous files, like you have the basic, you have the FBI files, Secret Service, CIA, You don't want to read any of the CIA files. They're just all lies. But the the actual documents that really tell the truth are buried in various administrative files or what are called miscellaneous files, and they're not grouped in with the regular body of research that most researchers access. So really it takes hundreds of hours of going through miscellaneous and what seem to be irrelevant files to find that one good one, right? So, plus a lot of the work that I've done has been cross-referencing. A lot of the Kennedy stuff, these guys use aliases, but not just any aliases. These guys, particularly in the CIA and the Mafia, they use aliases of people who they know, and so they can coach when the cops come and talk to them, right? So, a long time ago, they found out that if they use the identities of dead people, well, once the cops figure out they're dead people, the whole gig is up and they'll end up finding out who you are. But when you borrow aliases from people who are real, it becomes very difficult to track down who was the right person, right? So that's a technique that I've seen across the board in the Kennedy assassination that has made research, for most researchers, probably extremely difficult.
Damn, I would imagine so, definitely. So, yeah, let's get into this. What have you come up with?
Okay, well, we'll start with the bigger picture stuff, and I will do some screen share. The basics and this bigger picture stuff really was mostly put together by Michael Collins Piper. Michael Collins Piper, who, in my opinion, was assassinated by the people who did the Kennedy assassination. And really, it all goes back to the dispute between John F. Kennedy and David Ben-Gurion of Israel. So the reality is that John F. Kennedy was planning on having inspections at the Dimona nuclear facility. In 1960, the first reports came out that there was activity at a facility in a place called Dimona. And it was a very unique facility. And by looking at the structures, they could see that the structures being built were the same kind of structures that France had built for their nuclear power facilities. Now, Kennedy was dead set against nukes. He wanted to denuclearize the entire world. And Khrushchev, who's the only other person who had nukes, right, in the Soviet Union, the U.S. and Soviet Union were the only countries that had nukes. But here you have Israel, who is now building a facility, and Kennedy demanded inspections. And basically, he got blown off and told to, go stuff it, because they weren't going to have that. So you have that. And then you have a second aspect. You have the fact that between 1948 and 1963, you have many lobbying groups from Israel, the American Zionist Council, the World Jewish Congress. You have so many of these lobbying organizations that were obviously sent to the U.S. on behalf of the Israeli government, and they were refusing to register under what's called FARA, which is the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Now, FARA, any time that you are in the United States and you are doing something on behalf of another country, you have to register under FARA, because what it does is it prevents you from being able to contribute money to political campaigns. So if anyone knows anything about the Israeli lobby, we know that AIPAC is the biggest lobby in the world. They funnel billions and billions of dollars to American political candidates, and they do it illegally by funneling it through individual members, right? So instead of being able to donate $1 billion to a candidate, they will basically funnel that money through each of the individual members. So that's only one of a dozen different ways that Israel gets around FARA. But there have been requests for them to register, the for AIPAC and these other organizations to register, as recently as a year or two ago, right? So it's not something that's gone away. But between 1948 and 1963, it was nonstop evasion. And eventually, November 19th, 20th, and 21st, 1963, the council, the Committee on Foreign Relations, or whatever division handled FARA, they had a three-day meeting, went over the evidence, and on the 21st of November, 1963, they presented a letter to Israel demanding that the lobbying organizations register as foreign agents. And the next day, John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dealey Plaza. And on that day, no policies changed other than our policies towards Israel. Lyndon Johnson had basically squashed everything. He had squashed Israel's need to register under FARA. He squashed any kind of investigations into Dimona. And basically, he was their puppet president, and he was the first puppet president that we had, really, in this country. After that, every single president that we have had has been an Israeli puppet and basically placed in office. I'm showing right now on screen the letter to Prime Minister Eshkol, which was basically the demand to inspect Dimona. And then Ben-Gurion is the one who responded. Now, most people don't realize that even though Ben-Gurion was not in office, he was still the guy they went to, right? He was still the head of the country until his death. So the FARA registrations, like I said, began in 1948, and they went all the way through to 1963 when the Committee on Foreign Relations had their 88th Congress to decide this issue once and for all. And then once they decided the issue, it really didn't matter, because Kennedy was killed the next day. And now, one of the things that happened immediately after the Kennedy assassination, which is another reason that he needed to be removed, was that the Numec Corporation, which operated out of Pennsylvania, they, over a period of 5 years, diverted 287 kilos of plutonium from the U.S. to Israel, and that is where they got the plutonium for their nuclear bombs. So, as we all know, Mordecai Vanunu in the 1980s snuck a camera in, took a bunch of pictures, and he leaked to the entire world that Israel had in fact had nukes, and they had over 200. So To this very day, they have yet to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty because they don't feel that the rules apply to them. So that's kind of that's the background on why Kennedy was assassinated. And at this point, really, there can be no denying it, even though a lot of people try, because when you look at the relationships between Israel, the Mossad, the CIA, and even the United States Mafia, the connections go so deep that you can really look at them all as one organization. Which really stemmed from the 1948 deal that we cut with Reinhard Gehlen, which created NATO and the 17 intelligence agencies all basically the same time. The CIA came into existence in 1947, and by 1948 we had 17 intelligence agencies around the world and NATO, and they were all formed based on the relationship between the CIA, the Mossad, and Reinhard Gehlen. Reinhard Gehlen was the head of German intelligence during World War II. He was Adolf Hitler's spy master. And so most people don't realize, but everyone's heard of Operation Paperclip, where we got the nuclear scientists.
Right.
But before that, once we cut a deal with Reinhard Gehlen, we actually helped funnel 95% of the Nazi hierarchy out of Germany, out of Europe, and into South America and the U.S. 95%. So while at the Nuremberg trials, they basically killed 20 guys, 30 guys, something like that.
Yeah.
That was it. Thousands and thousands of the hierarchy of Nazis did not serve and get any punishment whatsoever. Some of these guys, like Otto Skorzeny, actually had their names removed from the war crimes list because of this deal that they cut. So it's actually a very fascinating story. Everyone should go out and read about Reinhard Gehlen, and then you'll know why the world seems like we're moving in a totalitarian fascist direction.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's why everything is the way it is now in this country.
Yeah, and not only this country, everywhere. All 17 of those nations that were part of NATO, NATO was formed by the concepts of Reinhard Gehlen. And there's a ton, too, that I'm not going to get into. But yeah, that's where it all began. And to touch back on NUMEC, I'm sharing a screen here that when they smuggled this nuclear material out of Pennsylvania, they actually contaminated the land with bomb-grade nuclear contamination. And it's still being cleaned up to this very day. So we're 50 years out, and we have a nuclear waste dump in Pennsylvania because Israel decided to divert our plutonium to their own use. So...
Wow, yeah, I've never heard of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, most people haven't, and it's really kind of a shame because there is so much to our history in the U.S. and really leading up to the Kennedy assassination. Kennedy was like the death knell for all this stuff. Kennedy kind of knew this. Kennedy saw what was going on, and people can say, oh, he was going to go after the mob. Well, the mob helped him get elected. You know, he stole that election. The Chicago mob stole three ballot boxes from three different districts, and that is what gave him the edge over Nixon. So basically, through his father, Joe Kennedy, they partnered with the mob. They got him elected, and then as soon as he's in office, his little brother goes after him fierce. You know, he went after Jimmy Hoffa, and he had all those all the congressional hearings trying to go after the mob. And they're like, "What is going on here?" Right? They thought they had an ally in the White House, but they didn't.
Right.
So, So it's really kind of complicated because John F. Kennedy, I would say, is the last president we ever had that wasn't a puppet. But at the same time, he stole that election, so it's just kind of ironic. But his opponent was Richard Nixon, who was basically an Israeli puppet from day one. They had more blackmail on that guy than anybody. See, that's how these things kind of operate. Like when Johnson got into office, Johnson was the first Jewish Zionist president. And most people don't realize that. They'll say to this day, we never had a Jewish president, but we absolutely did. And he reversed all policies towards Israel. And that's where we've been ever since. And if you look at some of the quotes from guys like Ariel Sharon, they'll straight up admit that they control us. You know, they control the United States.
So the decision was made, then what actions were taken next?
Okay, so it's easier to explain the relationships, because when you explain the relationships, it's easier than going through step by step how the orders got passed down.
All right.
But so going back to 48, when you have the creation of the security state, The person who was most responsible for that would be James Angleton. And James Angleton was a guy recruited by Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA. James Angleton was always, from day one, he was always looking out for the mole within the CIA. Well, he was the mole within the CIA, because everything that happened here got sent right back to Israel, because he was a Zionist. Now, Zionists, this is where it gets complicated. You could take hours explaining this, but the bottom line is there is a big difference between Orthodox Judaism and Zionism. Orthodox Judaism has been around for thousands of years. It's like every other religion. It's harmless. You know, nobody should discriminate on the basis of religion, race, or any of that thing. Identitarian politics are what's destroying definitely America and large portions of the societies around the world. But you have Zionists who are extremists. Zionism came around about the late 1800s. It's only been around for about 130 years. And Zionism started with the idea that there had to be a Jewish state. But the Zionists are not really Jewish. They're not religious. And if they are, they do not follow the Torah like Orthodox Jews. They follow the Talmud. And the Talmud is a 5,000-year-old Babylonian document that calls for human sacrifice. You know, and if you look at all the what's going on with the Temple of the Rock in Jerusalem, they've already built the sacrificial altar out back. I mean, it is insane. So you have Zionism, which is not Judaism. So criticism of Israel is not criticism of Jews. It's criticism of Zionists, because it is definitely a Zionist state, not a Jewish state. But I believe that between 1933 and 1945, while World War II was going on, the Zionists completely hijacked the religion of Judaism. They began to speak on behalf of Judaism. And this caused a major rift in the religion, because the Orthodox Jews basically were like, you have no right to speak for the Jewish people. You do not act like Jews, and you do not have any right to the Holy Land, because Orthodox Jews believe that across Judaism in its entirety, they're all pretty much waiting for the Messiah to return, right? So Christians think the Messiah has already been here and that it's Jesus, but Jews believe that the Messiah will return, and according to the Orthodox Jews, when the Messiah returns, the God's chosen people, which are the Jews, will be granted their own kingdom, right? So the Orthodox Jews believe that to be like a kingdom in heaven, right? Not an actual worldly country. But the Zionists, they interpret that as we will get our own land. But they couldn't wait. They had to jump the gun. And when you look at the relationship between the Zionists and Adolf Hitler during World War II, they were allies the whole time. He wanted them to go to Palestine. He wanted the Jews to go to Palestine. So he cut deals with the Zionists so that they could pretty much come and go as they pleased. And there were even cases where they needed to extract people out of concentration camps, and they had these Zionists dress up in Nazi uniforms and accompany the Nazis into the camps to help pick out the people that they needed to save. All the while, the Jews who were in the concentration camps were starving to death, were being executed. It was really a quite messed up situation, but it's because Zionists are political, they're not religious. They genuinely don't, I think they use the religion as the hook, so that if you criticize them, you're an anti-Semite, right? That's their ploy, and that's all it is. And it's even a strategy that they wrote about in the late 1800s. You know, if you read some of these old books, things by like Theodor Herzl or Shane Wiseman or any of these guys, they openly write about this stuff. That's how arrogant they are. So after the decision comes down, basically you have the relationship between, and I will open up I'll screen share once again.
Yeah, go for it.
And basically what you have, this is basically the top of the pyramid for the assassination. It started with the dispute with Kennedy and Ben-Gurion, and from there it goes to the Israeli Mossad, which at the time was led by Yitzhak Shamir, if I'm not mistaken. It was either Shamir or Rabin, but it really didn't matter, because these three guys were glued together at the hip. You have Menachem Begin, who is the father of all terrorism in the world. I'm not going to go off on a tangent on terrorism today, but basically every act of terrorism we've ever seen on this planet started with Zionists, not Muslims, Zionists. And Menachem Begin openly professes to have been the father of terrorism around the world. And if you look up the bombing of the King David Hotel in 1948, that was considered the first political act of terrorism in the 20th century. But really, that followed about 200 smaller bombings and assassinations. They were trying to get the British to leave Palestine so they could create their new Israeli state. So a little side note most people don't realize is that Yitzhak Shamir and Yitzhak Rabin were in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963. And we know that because Yitzhak Rabin's wife wrote a book, and she specifically stated in it that he was at, in Dallas that day. Now, him and Yitzhak Shamir, Yitzhak Rabin, and Menachem Begin were all in the U.S. at the time. Menachem Begin was in L.A. 3 weeks before meeting with Al Gruber. Al Gruber was the right-hand man to Mickey Cohen, but at this point in 63, Mickey Cohen, the famous gangster, he was in jail, and he gets killed with a pipe to the head. So basically, the order of command went from the Mossad to Meyer Lansky to Al Gruber. That was kind of like the chain of command for Jack Ruby, right? Because Jack Ruby never worked for the mob. He did work for the mob, but he was never a made man because he was Jewish and not Italian. His boss, once he met him, was Meyer Lansky. Meyer Lansky, people say, was the mob's accountant, but that's false. Meyer Lansky was the head of the global mafia syndicate. He ran the mob around the world. He was the one who set up relationships with the Yakuza and the triads in Asia. I mean, he was the guy who really built the global mafia structure. I don't know how it is today in 2019, but that's how it was back then. So just to give you an example, after Oswald was arrested, the first call that Jack Ruby made was to Al Gruber. And after the phone call with Al Gruber, Jack Ruby, from what everyone said who saw him, was that he was like a ghost. He was like, he was like scared or nervous. And that's because Al Gruber gave him the order to take out Oswald. Oswald had to go because Oswald was so deep involved with Jack Ruby and David Ferry and Clay Shaw and all these guys. That they couldn't risk him having survived. They could not risk him being around to tell the tale. So the next level down in the pyramid would be Alan Dulles, James Angleton, Ted Shackley, and William Harvey. Those were the four supervisors within the CIA that facilitated orders down to David Morales and George Bush, who was in Dealey Plaza that day also. And who do we have here? David Atlee Phillips, Richard Helms, and George Joannidis. Now, George Joannidis is a very important guy because a lot of the Kennedy assassination is so complex, and it has so many what people would call coincidences that it's like that couldn't possibly be real. Well, it could be real because how psychological warfare works is basically you have a guy, George Joannidis, who writes a script, right? And a script has actors in it, just like his orders have all the players below him in the CIA and in the mafia. Because the mafia and the CIA had been working together since the late 1800s, but their relationship had been reinforced through their relations in Cuba. Johnny Roselli was basically recruited into the CIA by a guy named Robert Mayhew, who was Howard Hughes's right-hand man. Now, the CIA had approached Hughes because he had a ton of money, and he thought it was really cool to be like a spy and to fund these guys, right? It was like an exciting thing for him to do. So that's kind of the relationship between the CIA and the mafia. And then you have like Johnny Roselli, who got recruited to go and work in Cuba and to take out Castro. But when you look at the list of mafia guys who were working with the CIA to go take out Castro, there was like 30 of them. It was a ton. The Cleveland guys, Leo Massari, you had Angelo Leonardo, you had so many guys across the country who were working with the CIA to take out Castro. But I have a different opinion on Castro. I think that really, I don't think they were trying to take him out at all. I think they were using him and Cuba as a focal point for smuggling drugs, weapons, and people. It was a stopover between that and Haiti, which served as two kind of ports of call for distribution of heroin and prostitutes and guns, basically. So if you ask me, I think the whole Castro thing was kind of a front. I think that he was a CIA asset the entire time. But good luck ever proving that, right? So after those guys, you have the mafia. And the head of the global mafia was Meyer Lansky. But you have these guys who are also directly connected to Israel through a company called Permandex, and I'll get to Permandex in a second. But you've got Joe Bonanno, and you got Mo Dalitz, and you got Meyer Lansky. Those were like, that was the upper crust of the mafia in the U.S. I know everyone thinks that Giancana was like the boss of the mafia in the U.S., but he wasn't. He was actually a front boss for a guy named Hyman Larner, who was a Jewish guy. And Hyman Larner's boss was Meyer Lansky. So that's the kind of pecking order in the U.S. mafia, because the Jewish mafia and the Italian mafia, which are really Sicilian mafia, they started working together really turn of the century. By the 20s, you know, there were Jewish guys in the Sicilian mafia. By 1963, when Kennedy was killed, the entire U.S. mafia was taken over by the Jewish mafia. Everybody who called the shots really used the Sicilians as front bosses. And that's just kind of how it was. And a lot of people don't want to wrap their head around that, but that's the reality of the matter. So you had like three or four guys in the mafia before it even got to Giancana and Trafficante and Marcello. Now, Trafficante, Marcello, and Giancana are the three names that constantly come up with the assassination, but they had bosses, right? And people like to forget about the fact that they actually had bosses. But the actual assignment of the assassins was from those three guys. So all the assassins were mafia. There were no anti-Castro Cuban assassins. There were no, you know, there were no CIA assassins. There were only Chicago Outfit, Murder Inc., and a couple of Trafficante's guys, and that was it.
That's something different than you hear from most other researchers.
Yeah, because most other researchers can't comprehend how the mafia, the CIA, and the Mossad are all one organization. They don't understand the large-scale power structure, and you can't understand it unless you research Reinhard Galen. And then once you study Reinhard Galen and Otto Skorzeny and the actual influence that the Nazis had over the creation of the security state, until you figure that out, none of the rest of it's ever going to make sense, ever. And that's the hardest part to really grasp. And people don't usually go back far enough, because really to understand, really to get a grip on it, you've got to go back to the late 1800s with the origins of Zionism and Theodore Herzl. That's where it begins. And most people don't go back that far. Maybe they go back to the end of World War II, but that's it. You know, so unless you're willing to go through World War II, World War I, and you know the late 1800s and the origins of Zionism, none of this is going to make sense.
Yeah, that's fantastic research so far.
Yeah, and of course you've got to study the Jewish takeover of the mob. You have to. I mean, there's no way around it. If you want to understand how Israel came to control the U.S. mafia, you need to understand how it was a slow infiltration over time. And by 1963, you know, because here's the thing. He who controls the money controls the world. And Meyer Lansky controlled the money. So when it was up, you know, up to the commission, which was like 20 mob bosses, they didn't have much choice in the matter, and if you ask them, they probably wouldn't say that they were subservient to Israel. But Meyer Lansky was the one who controlled the money. He controlled the he called the shots, and his allegiance was always to guys like Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir and Yitzhak Rabin. Those were the three guys at the time who were so directly connected. So in 1948, after the bombing of the King David Hotel, Menachem Begin had to get the hell out of. He had to get the hell out of Israel because he blew up a building, murdered 90 people, right? So he was hanging out in Los Angeles, and he was hanging out with Mickey Cohen, the legendary mobster, right? But in 1949, he recruited Mickey Cohen into the Irgun, which was one of the terrorist organizations that helped found Israel, right? Because you had the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Stern Gang. Those were the three organizations that were terrorists. There's no other way to put it. They'll spin it their own way, but that's what they were. They felt that they needed force to oust the British. And then once the British were ousted and they had a country, those three organizations over a period of 10 or 15 years kind of restructured into the IDF. And if you research the IDF, they have IDF branches all over the world. People can join the IDF all over the world. And when Israel calls on them, they will jump into action. So if that doesn't terrify people to death, I have no idea what will. That, or the idea of Israel having nukes. Because the entire reason Israel wanted nukes is because if they are ever attacked or in danger of being eliminated, they're taking the rest of the world out with them. They're not having nukes to defend themselves. They have nukes as a last option because they're not going alone. That's pretty, I mean, if you read some of these documents about the American Zionist Council and all this stuff and some of the personal communications, this was their plan the whole time. They wanted nukes because they're not going out alone. Kind of like an insurance policy so nobody takes them out, which to me is just monstrous. All right, so the next thing we should probably talk about is Permandex.
Okay.
All right, so Permandex is a Mossad front company. It had several branches, but basically they were an assassination factory. They were responsible for multiple attempts on the life of Charles de Gaulle in France. They used an organization called the OAS, which was kind of like an underground French resistance organization. And that French resistance organization was also working with Israel to set up what's called the French Connection. I'm sure you've heard of the French Connection. Yeah. The heroin smuggling ring that basically took heroin from France and it got shipped down to Galveston, Texas. Now, Galveston, Texas is very important because Galveston was the biggest port in Texas back in the 1960s. I mean, you also had Port Arthur, and I believe you had a port off in New Orleans. But when you did large-scale importing into the U.S., it went through Galveston. And a huge part of the assassination involves David Ferry's trip to Galveston. And it also involves Rose Sheremy and her trip getting kicked out of the car and a seaman getting off of the boat and bringing 10 pounds of heroin. But basically, on Permandex, they were a front organization that all they did was funnel money. And they funneled money for supplying heroin from France to the U.S. and for assassinations around the world. Now, this is really the proof of the overlap of these organizations, because the key Permandex members, if you look at the screen, you'll see, and this is only about half of the Permandex board members, you will see that they are from all over these different organizations. They're from the CIA, they're from the Mossad, they're from the U.S. Mafia. So Permandex is the focal point, it's the nexus, it's the overlap of all these various organizations, and it's the proof that all these organizations were working together. So the key people on here, well, you got Louis Bloomfield, who was the president. You have Ferenc Nagy, who was the former Hungarian prime minister. Jean de Menil, who was connected to the Dallas Oil people. And then you have Roy Cohn. Do you know who Roy Cohn is?
I've heard the name.
Roy Cohn was Trump's lawyer for his whole life until he died in the mid-1980s. So Roy Cohn, and that's Donald Trump's connection to the Kennedy assassination. I don't know if you remember, but he had accused Ted Cruz's dad of being out there with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, I remember something about that.
Okay, so he kind of tipped his hand there with some insider information because he was mistaken about Ted Cruz's dad's association with that particular incident. But Ted Cruz's dad worked for George Bush and I forget the name of Prescott Bush's oil company. He worked for Bush's oil company, and he is rumored to have been present at the trademark where Kennedy was heading to. So Ted Cruz's dad was definitely connected to people connected to the assassination, and Trump, by saying that, basically tipped his hand that he had inside info, which is pretty insane for him to have said. But you've got Joe Bonanno. Joe Bonanno's New York mobster connected to the Genovese family. You've got James Angleton, who is, you know, the biggest scumbag that's ever lived. Then you've got Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw, who the JFK movie was made basically about, he was the CEO of Permandex. And they didn't mention this in the movie, but Garrison knew that. Garrison knew all about Permandex. That's why he went after Clay Shaw. And the problem with the JFK movie was that was actually a disinformation movie. That movie was produced by a guy named Arnon Milchan, who was the Mossad's biggest arms dealer. So there's not one single mention in that movie about Israel or any of this stuff, because he made sure there wouldn't be, because they made the movie. You know, they made the movie because there was enough attention on the Kennedy assassination still, you know, 30 years after it had happened, that they felt the need to make a movie to distract attention from it.
Yeah, I knew there would have to be at least some level of disinformation in a huge movie like that. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so after that, you've got a guy named George Montello. George Montello is basically, he's connected to all kinds of people, definitely good friends with Angleton. He was connected to the Italian fascists in the 70s and the late 60s, who basically implemented what was called I always forget what this is called, the policy of, not a policy of terror. I'm sorry, I forget the name, but basically they committed about a dozen terrorist acts in Italy in the late 1960s and 70s. And they did it because they wanted to scare people into voting for an authoritarian government. I mean, that's the MO the whole time, right? I mean, look what happened after 9/11. The president got powers to where he can start wars around the world, right? So they kind of scare people into voting a certain way. Now, we lost our democracy on November 22nd, 63. None of our votes have counted since then. So it really, for us, it doesn't really matter. But in other countries, they use this kind of policy. Oh, it was the policy of tension. That's what it was called. It was called the policy of tension. And that that was basically meant to kind of get people to vote for the candidate who swore that they would go after these people, right, when it was them doing it the whole time. It's false flag terrorism. Zionists are the originators of false flag terrorism. And going back to, all you have to do is study Israel and the incidents of terror leading up to its foundation in 48, and you'll see that's where that came from. The myth of Islamic terrorism stemmed from that. I mean, you have with 9/11, you've got urban moving systems. You've got the dancing Israelis, right, who were stupid enough to get caught. But you also have got guys in a box truck full of explosives down by the George Washington Bridge that got arrested, whose information got squashed, right? I mean, they found a van packed with explosives under Tower 1, and it was marked urban moving systems. And that went out over the radio, and then that building came down. So nobody ever really talks about that, but we know that because it's on the radio transcripts, right? So, and not only that, earlier that year, Urban Moving Systems had moved one of the terrorists from Florida to New York. Literally, they drove him with his stuff from Florida to New York. So, I mean, this Israel being the root of all terror in the world is a fact. It's not even speculation anymore. If you know, if you understand what you're looking at when you read documents, it's easy to tell that we've been lied to, you know, ever since Kennedy.
It's the same players for all these major staged or false flags events, right?
Oh, 100%. It's always the same players. Now, obviously, the individuals die, right? So you got these guys probably dead in the 70s or 80s, but you have a new batch of Mossad, you have a new batch of Zionists, you have, it's the same philosophy, it's the same originating in the same country. Now, a lot of people will say, well, it's the Vatican, it's got the secret societies and blah, blah, blah. Well, the secret societies, if you look at all of them, number one, I think they're just recruiting mechanisms and they're ways to evaluate someone's dedication to a cause, right? That's why you have these different levels. You might be a high level, a 33rd level Mason or a 7th level Mason, right? I think like depending on what you're willing to do determines how high up you go in these ranks. And these secret societies, the one thing that they all have in common, the one thing that all these people, the CIA, the Mafia, Israel, the secret societies, the one thing they all have in common, the one underlying factor, they're all Zionists. Whether they're Jewish or Christian Zionists doesn't matter. And I have a whole theory on why they are all Zionists. And it basically has to do with world domination. You know, these guys are fascists born from the doctrine of Reinhard Gehlen, whose only mission in life after the war was to preserve Adolf Hitler's only organization, which was the SS. And that was his goal. And basically that's what he did without calling it that, right? So, and all these guys in the CIA, they all went along with it because that's what they wanted. They want to be able to control the world because us peasants, why should we have a say, right? So, all right. Now, let's move on to Johnson. Now, I already said Johnson was the first Jewish president. He was the first Zionist president. But by the time Johnson got to office, all of his men were had been recruited by the CIA. The only one of them still living who could go to jail is Bill Moyers. And Bill Moyers was... he was so deep in this assassination, he was the one who told the Secret Service that they didn't need the hard top on the convertible. Bill Moyers needs to go to prison, and he won't. But the other guys here are Jack Valenti, Lem Johns, Clifton Carter, and Marty Underwood. Now, most people have never heard of Marty Underwood or Jack Valenti. But Jack Valenti basically had hooked up with Johnson back in 56. He owned an advertising company called Weekly and Valente, and he basically handled some of Kennedy's campaign stuff, but he handled all of Johnson's campaign stuff, right? And so he had had homosexual blackmail on Johnson. I don't know from what year, but if you read Jack Valenti's file, it's like 600 or 700 pages. It's, I swear, it's the most intriguing read you'll ever have. Coupled with the Kennedy assassination, it is some of the best, you know, who needs fiction when you got this stuff? But Jack Valenti started out, he's born into a mob family. He's related to Umberto Valente. He had deep connections to Joseph Villo in Dallas, to Mo Dalitz in Las Vegas, to Lucky Luciano before Luciano died. And so, like, when he got married, and this is a funny story, Jack Valente married Johnson's secretary, right? And they had two kids, but only they didn't, because Jack Valente is a homosexual. And so basically, he would bring his wife to the White House, and Johnson would continue to bang Jack Valente's wife, and the two kids that Jack Valente had are actually Johnson's kids. He's what's called a beard. So he was kind of like a front husband, you know? It gave him cover, because back in the day, it was illegal to be a homosexual. You could go to jail for that, right? So he used it as a cover, and it was a cover for Johnson to be able to continue his relationship with his secretary, right? Under the cover of, oh, this is Jack's wife. So that's a little fascinating tidbit, totally on a side story. But so Jack Valente, which I love to hate Jack Valente, because there's so much here. We could do a whole podcast just on Jack Valente. So I'm going to skip a lot of the stuff. But basically, after 1966, he went on to go run Hollywood at the MPAA, and he was the head of the MPAA for 40 years. So he controlled the propaganda that came out of Hollywood for the last 40 years. That he is such an important person in American history, and most people have never heard of him. I definitely need to write a book about him, because no one has ever ventured to tackle what is Jack Valente. He was OSS in World War II. He flew 51 bombing missions. He was definitely recruited by the CIA. He was definitely in with all the mobsters. He was perfectly in with all this group. And he was in with the Humble Oil guys. He worked for Humble Oil. So he was in with Johnson, and he was in with Albert Thomas, and he was in with all the guys down in Texas who mattered. Okay, so already talked about Johnson and Numek and Jack Valente. So this is kind of, this is an overly simplified chart of the kind of structure that it went through, right? So you've got you got literally a couple hundred people in the middle of this chart, but this is the very simplified version. So it basically went from David Ben-Gurion to the Mossad, which is Begin, Rabin, and Shamir. And so Begin had recruited Mickey Cohen back in 49. Al Gruber was Mickey Cohen's right-hand man. Jack Ruby made the phone call. Al Gruber gave the order to hit Oswald. And then Jack Ruby's best friends growing up were three guys on the hit team. So going down from Meyer Lansky, it goes to Hyman Lerner, and then it goes down to Sam Giancana and Carlos Marcello, and they provided most of the shooters. Traficante provided some. I haven't figured out who he provided yet, but I can tell you that Sam Giancana provided Dave Yaris, Lenny Patrick, Robert Bernard Baker, Jim Braden, who actually got busted and in Dealey Plaza and is well documented. And then you got Marshall Caifano and Richard Kane. Now, there were only three, possibly a fourth shooter, but there were at least seven or eight rifles, right? Because it goes in waves. If you don't hit them by the first checkpoint, the first person shoots, it doesn't get him by the first checkpoint. You go to the second, and the second checkpoint, you have a different wave of shooters. And the final wave of shooters was one on the grassy knoll, and you had one up on the overpass that didn't shoot. So really, you had two guns on the grassy knoll, one gun on the overpass, and two out of those three did not shoot because it wasn't necessary. That's kind of how that structure worked. Now, the connection from Jack Ruby to everyone, it goes from Jack Ruby to Sam Giancana. Jack Ruby knew everybody, because once he hooked up with Meyer Lansky, he got free rein to go everywhere, and he could talk with whomever he wanted to, because he was on orders from Meyer Lansky, right? So you've got Sam Giancana, who provided the shooters, and then from Jack Ruby to David Ferry, there's plenty of documentation on their relationship, and from David Ferry to Clay Shaw, who's the Permandex CEO, right? And so basically, this is just another kind of breakdown of the relationships between all these people. George de Morneschild, one of the most crucial people in the entire assassination, he's got about six different aliases. If you go through the literature, it takes a lot of cross-referencing and looking at height, weight, descriptions. You've really got a lot of kind of eliminating people from suspect possibility based on descriptions. It's kind of hard to explain, but him, and he resembled a guy named Sergio Arcacha Smith, who was basically an anti-Castro Cuban, but he also had done some bagman work for Carlos Marcello. Him and a guy named Emilio Santana, they were both in Dealey Plaza. I don't believe that they were shooters, because the mob would not have trusted a non-Italian to shoot, right? Virtually all the shooters were Jewish and Italian. So And then you have James Angleton, and James Angleton's direct contact with the mob was through a guy named Mario Broad. Mario Broad, which is possibly an alias for a guy named Mike Broderick. I haven't been able to confirm that yet, but the Chicago Outfit used a guy named Mike Broderick for a lot of their stuff, and Mario Broad is the name that's connected to Angleton as his contact. And these guys back then weren't overly sophisticated. They would change their names slightly. Like, there's a guy involved in the shooting whose name is Robert McEwen. He used the alias of Thomas McKenna, right? So they would change their name slightly, but not a whole lot, you know? So back, they were really sloppy. I mean, this is kind of like the biggest operation they had and the most need for this kind of obfuscation. And it's really clear that they hadn't really worked out systems that completely worked. And they never anticipated something like an internet coming along where you can pull all this information and cross-reference it, right?
Right.
So I can pull up every single one of these guys' life histories. None of these people ever imagined that something like that would exist, right? So there's a couple things that I discovered that no one else has discovered. I completely identified. So David Ferry goes on a trip the night of the assassination. He goes to Houston. He goes to an ice skating rink. And then he leaves supposedly to go to another ice skating rink. Well, I identified the owner of the ice skating rink. I identified her whole family. I identified the real identities of all the people who worked there, even though they gave fake names. And basically what they were doing was handing off one of the shooters. One of the shooters came down from Dallas to Houston. There's a chance that David Ferry wasn't even at the ice skating rink and that it was a double. Because when he got there, he kept making it a point to say, "Hey, I'm here. I'm David Ferry." And he said it to the guy who was working at the time at least five times. So he's trying to make it a point that he's noticed that he's there, which means it probably wasn't David Ferry there. David Ferry was probably out shuttling around assassins. But that point of contact at the Winterland ice skating rink, very important in figuring out who the actual shooters were. And the Grassy Knoll shooter, I believe, was the person who was handed off there. Now, I haven't been able to come up with his identity yet, but it's coming from a very limited pool of people. So, I mean, realistically, there's only three or four people who it could be based on the circumstances that I'm familiar with. You know, I just haven't been able to narrow it down. I'm getting there, though. Once I completely solve this Galveston thing and the Tippit shooting. The Tippit shooting, I'm pretty sure I know who actually shot, and we'll cover some of the evidence on that here in a minute. But those are the only two things I have left, really, is the Grassy Knoll shooter and the Galveston trip, ironing out all the details of what happened there. Because they left from there to go to Port Arthur, then they went to Vinton, and then they went to Alexandria. And Alexandria, I believe, is where the home of the Grassy Knoll shooter was, based on everything I've researched so far.
Yeah, this is great stuff. This is stuff that you don't hear from any other researchers.
No, because too many researchers, like I said, unless you understand the relationship between the mafia, the CIA, and the Mossad, you're never going to get any of this. And then how could the Dallas police, the mayor of Dallas, the Secret Service, the FBI, how could them all be in on it? Well, easy, because the guys who were in on it were in the OSS with James Angleton, and that's where their loyalties lied. They never changed. Hell, going to join the Secret Service and the FBI might have been their order from Angleton at the time. You know what I mean? So he could have said, hey, because the OSS dissolved in 45, the CIA came about in late 47, so you had 2.5 years. So they had 2.5 years for their people to go out and infiltrate other organizations. That's how you can have all these organizations in on it, because they were really all just loyal to the OSS and James Angleton. And ultimately, James Angleton was loyal to Israel, not us. So there were three JFK assassination plots that have been documented in the weeks leading up to the assassination. There was one in Chicago. The plot was foiled by a guy named Abraham Bolden, the first black Secret Service agent. He's actually still alive, considering giving him a call and talking to him. The patsy in that case was Thomas Valley, and he was actually detained. No charges ended up being brought ultimately because they couldn't prove anything, but there was enough information to know he had rifles in his room. He had tons of ammunition. He was running with the mob and the CIA. And if you look up the Chicago plot, there's tons of information out there on that. Then you have the Tampa plot, November 18th, 63. The plot was foiled again, and it was reported in a newspaper, and the patsy in that case was a guy named Gilberto Lopez. Gilberto Lopez was a CIA agent, lower level. He worked for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. We'll get into that here in a little bit. Fair Play for Cuba Committee was where Oswald worked, in New Orleans when he was arrested for handing out the pamphlets on the street. He had that staged fight with Carlos Bernier, and that basically got him that interview on TV at WDSU was the TV station, which actually ties in later to David Ferry's Galveston trip. It's pretty interesting. And then you have November 19th, the next day in Miami. Now, this one actually was canceled very early, the assassination plot was, because the Kennedy Secret Service guys in Miami, they found out about it, and they did not allow him to have a motorcade. And the FBI documents show that that involved two guys, one guy named Bernardo de Torres and another guy named Manuel Artime. Now we'll go over some JFK myths. There's so many myths out there with JFK. Really, it's just nobody knows. Nobody really can tell you what happened just by, you know, if you watch the JFK movie and you read a book or two, you're never going to understand where any of this stuff comes from. So what's first? All right, so first we'll talk about the Walker shooting. Everyone keeps saying that Lee Harvey Oswald attempted to shoot Walker at his house, but that is definitely not true. He never owned that rifle. We'll get into the rifle, but he never owned a Mannlicher rifle. He never owned a 38 handgun. And he was basically, he was set up. The whole thing was set up from the top down. But with the Walker shooting, you had a neighbor of Walker. He was 14 years old, named Kirk Coleman. And basically, he was out back, and he heard the shooting, and he looked over the fence, and he basically saw two cars there parked, but still running. And he saw one guy run and get into the first car and take off. He saw the second guy run and open the front door and put something in the back seat of the car and then take off, right? So you've got two guys who shot at the Walker house. So Oswald was most definitely not there, and he most definitely did not own the rifle that they said he owned. So that one, I wish people would really kind of stop saying that he shot at Walker, and that was proof he shot at Kennedy, because he didn't shoot at Walker. Okay, so next, bullets found in the limo. Besides the, you know, the reason that we have the single bullet theory, which is the biggest lie, one of the biggest lies ever told the American people, was because they had to account for three bullets, right? The first bullet, they say, hit Kennedy in the back, went through him, went through Connolly, broke like seven bones, and came out completely unscathed. And then you have the bullet that went over the car, ricocheted off the curb, and hit James Tague on the face, cutting him. And then you had the headshot, right? So they say there's three bullets. Well, that is complete bullshit. There were so many more shots fired than that. And it's obvious here because you have two additional bullets that were pulled out of the front seat of Kennedy's limo, right? So there's five right there. And then during the autopsy, I think it was Humes, wanted some more pieces of skull bone to try to reconstruct the skull. So he sent some Secret Service guys out to the car to bring back as many pieces as they could find. They brought back a couple pieces, and they brought back another intact bullet. So you have three bullets pulled out of the limo in the actual documentation from the FBI and Secret Service, and in this letter from one of the doctors who was actually in the autopsy the entire time, right? So that just debunks the single shooter right there. And then you have additional fragments in Connolly. Besides the ones that he's buried with, they pulled out significant fragments of bullets. He was probably struck with three different bullets. He probably was not hit with, it probably wasn't even two bullets. It was probably three bullets. They were shot from an upward angle. They were probably shot from the west end of the book depository by Richard Kane. That is the conclusion that I've come to, is that Richard Kane was the shooter in the west side of the depository. It was probably Howard Lawrence, who was the shooter on the east side of the depository. Heavy set Hispanic male with a tan jacket and a open collared shirt. I think I just found a picture of him in Daily Plaza too, so that I'm still working on. Okay, so they say that they found three hulls underneath the window in the book depository, and that's a lie. This is the crime scene report from Daily Plaza, from the book depository. The crime scene guy pulled two hulls and a live round it was two hulls under the window and one live round inside the Carcano. So there weren't three, there were two. So where did the other three come from? This is right here. This is two hulls pulled, and this is the photography report once the hulls got back to the crime lab. So they photographed them at the scene, and they photographed them at the crime lab. Now, the proof that we have two different sets of hulls or shells or casings, whatever you'd like to call them, is based on what's in the FBI documentation and the Dallas Police Department documentation of the chain of custody. So you have two holes that went from officers Day to Brown to Williams, and then you have the three holes that went from Day to Sims to Fritz. Now, these chains of custody are inside the reports. They're in the Dallas police reports. They're inside the FBI reports. There's no reason that this information hasn't been brought to the public's attention sooner. Now, but where exactly did those three extra holes come from? Oh, and this is the photograph. This is the original photograph of the two holes. So, and this was the FBI photograph showing that there were two and a live round. So a 7.65 Mauser was located, and there's some conflicting evidence on where that was actually located. Inside the Dallas police reports, it says that it was found on the sixth floor near the stairwell. But the initial information that was actually leaked to the radios, the radio stations, they said that it was actually in the stairwell on the fifth floor, and the three holes were nearby. So it's anyone's guess where exactly they found them. But this is the document that from the FBI that was submitted to the Warren Commission. It's exhibit number 3048. Clearly says that a Mauser 7.65 was found. And like I just showed here, we've got at least three police reports showing a Mauser 7.65 within the book depository. So the story of where the 7.65 Mausers came from Russell Buffalino through Frank Sheeran and Tony Provenzano to David Ferry. It's a fascinating story. Not going to have too much time to get into it today, but we've got the chain of where the rifles came from. And it was actually two shipments of rifles. The first shipment of rifles, the guys who had the rifles got in a chase with the police. They wrecked the car and the rifles got confiscated and they were in jail at the time of the shooting. That's a great story. Anyone wants to look up that, they can look up The Fourth Tramp. Or Oswald Talked, I think was a book that was written about that. So a lot of this information, like I'm telling you, I didn't just make it up. It's out there, right? So there should have been some other researcher who has figured this out. But here's the problem with the JFK researchers. They want to write books and make money, right? They don't want to solve this thing. They solve this thing, and there goes their cash cow. You know what I mean? So they keep putting out information that doesn't address the big picture. Okay, next. There was a .30-06 Johnson rifle found in Dealey Plaza the next day by the Dealey Plaza lawn crew. This rifle was traced back to a guy named Richard Hathcock through fingerprints. Richard Hathcock was a private detective, but he also, I think, had a pawn shop or something along those lines. But basically, Jerry Hemming had this .30-06 Johnson rifle, and he pawned it to this guy, Richard Hathcock. And Richard Hathcock had a guy working for him named Roy Payne, P-A-Y-N-E. And when they found the rifle in the lawn, the FBI pretty much somehow they got the fingerprints on it and traced back to Richard Hathcock very quickly, like within a couple of days. So they go out to him and they ask him what's up with the rifle. And he goes, oh, Jerry Hemming is the leader of Interpen, which is basically just a mercenary group. They were the group that got raided at Lake Pontchartrain. That was in the JFK movie. But he pawned the rifle, and then Lauren Hall, who worked with him, went and picked it up about a week before the assassination, and then it's found in Dealey Plaza the next day. And we have the entire chain of custody of the rifle. It was even captured for a split second in one of the films, but that film has since disappeared.
Very interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. There was also an Enfield rifle found on the roof of the Texas School Book Depository. And this was actually captured on what was called the Montesana film. I hope I pronounced that right. But this is the only image from it. You can see, you can't really see what's going on here. You can see better in the video. The video is only about 2 seconds long, and you really got to look close. But he's handling, on the guy standing on the left side is handling the rifle right then and there. It was brought down from that ladder that you can see right above him from the roof of the depository. All right, let's talk about the magic bullet. The magic bullet, there's a reason that the magic bullet is in pristine condition, and that's because it never hit anything. And that's because it's not really the magic bullet. So the guy who found the magic bullet, his name was O.P. Wright. He was one of two people who actually found the magic bullet in Parkland Hospital. And back then, he turned it in to the Dallas Police Department. And then the Dallas Police Department turned it in to the FBI. So the FBI comes back to him a couple years later, but before any pictures of it have ever been out. And they show him pictures of CE-399, which is what everyone has come to know as the magic bullet. But it's not the magic bullet. He refuses to identify it as the magic bullet. He's a gun guy. He knows ballistics. And so he says, no, it was not this bullet. It was a pointed tip 30-06 round. And he actually had a 30-06 round in his pocket, and he pulled it out and showed it to him. And he said, this is what it looked like. It was a pointed tip. But to this day, the myth of the magic bullet still persists. Another fascinating story is that that wasn't the only bullet found in Parkland that day. There was a nurse who, in the basement, just where the alleged magic bullet was found, she found another bullet that was still cased, that hadn't even been fired. It was a 30-06 round just like this, and it was still in its jacket, had never been fired. So whoever planted the bullets, and I think it might have been Jack Valente who planted the bullets, because he's one of the only people who admitted to being in the basement of the Parkland Hospital that day. So you have the entire story surrounding the magic bullet is just BS. It's complete BS. The bullet that they say is the magic bullet never shot a damn thing because it was a 30-06 round that was actually found. So moving on. Okay, now let's talk about the rifle. The money order that Oswald allegedly used is a fake. So down at the lower left here, I have an example of a real money order. It's on that kind of cardstock, like greenish cardstock. It's got very rigid, defined edges. And if you look at the money order that Oswald used, the big red flag is that it's got ink bleed through for the stamp that's dated March 12th. So if you see that, it's bleeding through to the back. That is on paper. That is not cardstock. No money orders were issued on cardstock in 1963. So the entire story about him having a P.O. box, him ordering a rifle, it's all BS. This was a fabrication by the FBI. They faked this money order to frame him. He never went by the name, so the name Alec Heidel, I didn't make a slide on this one, I really should have, but they say he went by Alec Heidel. Well, Marina Oswald was a Russian spy. She was in on the setup from day one. And when the FBI confronted Marina Oswald about the signature on his Alec Heidel draft card, she admitted that that was her signature. She signed it and probably put it in his wallet. He probably didn't even know that he had that card on him. Huh. So the whole thing was a big setup.
That's amazing.
Yep. And thanks to serial numbers, they were able to trace the Carcano rifle back to a CIA agent named Samuel Cummings. Samuel Cummings, he owned a company called Adams Consolidated. Adams Consolidated is the company that imported the rifle from Italy to the United States. And it was imported to the U.S. using a company called Crescent Firearms, which was another CIA company. Klein Sporting Goods, that's another CIA company. After the assassination, at least three or four guys who were involved in the assassination went to go work at Klein's in Chicago, right? So the entire chain of custody of the rifle from the person who imported it all the way to allegedly Klein's, which I doubt it ever went to Klein's, were all CIA. The money order's fake. I mean, can you see how none of this is real? Like, none of what people have been told is real at all. And Cummings, one of his best friends in Italy was a guy named Enrico Fratoli, who sat on the board of CMC Permindex. So you have the complete loop there. Like I said, this thing is scripted like a Hollywood movie, you know? It doesn't get much better than this. Now, if you look at the serial numbers on the different rifles, they're all different. The Warren Commission, the serial number on the rifle that was photographed by the Warren Commission is different than the font on the serial number that was in Life magazine. Right? Huh. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they're all so freaking dumb that, like I said, they didn't know that the internet would be out, and they never thought people would have pictures of them right next to each other, but the fonts are all different. All right, what's next? Oh, yeah, there were two Oswalds. This is not even speculation anymore. This has pretty much been confirmed. That what you're looking at are two different people. The guy on the left is 2 inches taller, about 30 pounds heavier. He's got a thick neck. And basically, going back to at least 1953, when Oswald was about 12 or 13 years old, you have complete documentation of two separate sets of work histories, two separate sets of friends, two separate sets of addresses that they lived at. And it's just crazy. This picture on the left was taken by Robert Oswald, who was definitely in on all this, and I'll explain how in a second. Robert Oswald took that picture of his brother in 1958. And in 1963, when Oswald's arrested, that's him on the right. It's just clearly two different people. The Oswald who went to Russia is not the Oswald that came back from Russia. And I don't know. There's not much more to say about that. A guy named John Armstrong, I believe his name is, wrote a book called Harvey and Lee. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But first, we'll get to the two Marguerite Oswalds. See, Oswald had two different mothers. Now, he didn't really have two different mothers. One of them, if there was even a Lee Harvey Oswald at all, he had one, and the other Lee Harvey Oswald had the other. So if you look along the bottom here, you see these photographs and the big photograph of the woman on the left. That was his mother really up until about 1950, I think about 57. And after 57, I think you start having pictures of the other Marguerite Oswald, right? So if you can, I don't know if you can tell in these, but this Marguerite Oswald on top with the glasses had a mole under her eye and the other one did not, right? So they didn't even pick two women that looked alike.
Oh, yeah.
This is the difference. In 1956, that's her on the left. 1957 is the other one in the middle. And 1965 is her on the right. All of these, both of these women are credited as being Marguerite Oswald. And if you tell anyone that there were two Marguerite Oswalds, they will tell you that you're freaking crazy. But they're not. And the person who uncovered all this, I believe his name was John Armstrong. He came to some poor conclusions. He established amazing data. But some of his conclusions, I think, are faulty. And I'll go over that here in a second. Okay, so John Armstrong called one of these guys Lee, and he called the other one Harvey. And I kind of understand why he did it, to kind of keep them, you know, separate. But from 1953 to 1958, you have these two completely separate life histories. But after 1958, it jumps from two people using his identity to about six or seven. So in 1959, you know, Lee is with the CIA-sponsored anti-Castro guerrilla groups in Louisiana and Florida. And that is correct. He was at Lake Pontchartrain. He was in with David Ferry out of New Orleans. But at the same time, you have someone going off and defecting to the Soviet Union, right? So, and then here we go again, 60 and 61. This is pretty well known. Somebody tried to go buy a car in his name while he was still over in the Soviet Union. And even J. Edgar Hoover had written a letter addressing this. Saying, hey, we think someone's using Oswald's information. We should probably look into this, right? But where I believe John Armstrong got it wrong is he has here listed Lee visits the Texas Employment Commission in 62. And that's while Harvey was still in the Soviet Union. But however, the person who was identified as having visited the Texas Employment Commission was a guy named Larry Crawford. And I'll talk more about him in a second. And then in 63, the next two references sets up Harvey as the patsy. That was most likely William Seymour, because you have an incident where Lee Harvey Oswald is allegedly at the shooting range, and he is shooting he shot the target of the guy next to him, almost like to draw attention to himself. That was even in the JFK movie. That has pretty much been confirmed to have been William Seymour, because the guy he was there with was Lawrence Howard, the guy who I think was on the east wing of the Texas School Book Depository. There's a lot more reasons why it's William Seymour. Plus there were some other people who confirmed that William Seymour was imitating Oswald. So right around 58, 59, that's where I think John Armstrong kind of loses his grasp on who was impersonating Oswald. But from 53 to 58, it was definitely the same person, growing up, going to high school, joining the Marines. When you look into, you know, where they were in the Marines and what classes they took in the Marines and all that stuff, it's like a dead giveaway that there's some CIA action going on here. This, I could talk a whole show just about this, the Harvey and Lee theory. But just know there were absolutely two Lee Harvey Oswalds. And, these four guys, plus at least three others had impersonated Oswald. Saul Sage, that's the heavyset looking guy in the upper left. Saul Sage was the guy who went to the Soviet embassy when Oswald was allegedly in Mexico, but Oswald really never went to Mexico City. That's a whole other story I can't get into today. And then you have Larry Crawford. Larry Crawford was most likely the person who shot Tippit. And then you have William Seymour and Kerry Thornley. Kerry Thornley, so Perry Russo was a witness for Garrison, and Perry Russo made a big deal that he was at a party in New Orleans back in the 60s where Oswald and Clay Shaw were at together. The reality was that it wasn't Oswald, it was Kerry Thornley who was using Oswald's name at the time. That, if you go through the thousands of pages of documents I've read, becomes pretty obvious. Now, here's where I'm really going to blow your mind. So many people think this is Jack Ruby in the hallway of the police department, but that's not Jack Ruby. That's Jack Ruby's double. But Jack Ruby's double is a little bit easier to explain. That's his brother Samuel. So Jack Ruby had a brother named Samuel. Nobody in the JFK research, you know, community ever mentioned Samuel Ruby. But Samuel Ruby moved to Dallas a year and a half before the assassination. And when you read about Jack Ruby, half the people who knew Jack Ruby said that he was a hothead and he would, you know, go off on a drop of a dime and he would beat people up. And then the other half say that he was had the warmest heart. He was the nicest guy you ever met, right? Very conflicting accounts. And then during the days of November 20th through the 24th, when Ruby shot Oswald, there are many accounts of Ruby being in two places at once. And this is how he did it. It was his brother Samuel who actually went around as Jack Ruby, from what I can tell, as his identity. And it wasn't like Jack Ruby wasn't in on it. These guys were both running with the mob and the CIA and the Mossad, right? So
were they twins? Because they look like twins.
They're not. They're actually like a year apart.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty fascinating, huh?
Definitely.
So yeah, no one ever talks about Ruby's double, but there definitely was a Ruby's double. It took me a long time to figure it out. Once I realized that the guy in the hospital was not, or the guy in the police department was not Jack Ruby, it was like, wow, it became obvious that there was a Jack Ruby double. But yeah, that one's his brother Samuel. And like, honestly, I don't even think Jack Ruby was in Dallas during the assassination. I think he was already in Galveston, but that's a whole nother story. Okay, so Ruby's cancer. Okay, we can stop talking about Ruby having a CIA super cancer. One of Garrison's investigators had a conversation with Monk Zeldin, who was Ruby's doctor, and he had a medical report showing Ruby had cancer as back as 63, right? So Ruby had cancer as far back as 63. He didn't die until 67 or 68, but people are saying he got injected with some CIA superbug. No, he had cancer the whole freaking time. And if you look here, you can clearly tell. In 54, when he was arrested, he was a big, heavy guy. 1963, here he started losing weight. That cancer was already eating at him in 63. So it's not really a mystery that the CIA didn't give him some superbug. He died naturally. I think it'd be nice to put that rumor to bed.
Right.
And what's next? All right, so let's talk about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Fair Play for Cuba Committee was a CIA operation from day one. What the CIA would do is they started at least a dozen pro-Cuban organizations. They funded them. They had people go out and do things like Oswald handout brochures. And then what they would do is they would go to the president and be like, look at all this CIA, look at all this, these Cuban, pro-Cuban groups popping up. We need funding to fight this, right? When they were creating it in the first place, right? This is what the CIA does. They fabricate reality. And the proof that we have is that a Newsweek article came out and talked about, basically, this is Richard Gibson. Richard Gibson started the Fair Play for Cuba Committee with Robert Tabor, back in like 1960 or 61. So basically these two guys, Richard Gibson and Robert Tabor, they were CIA their whole careers. They say they weren't until after Fair Play for Cuba, but come on, it makes no sense. And they were down there meeting with Fidel Castro in the late 50s. And in the late 50s, the CIA was the only people who were in direct contact with him because they were funding him to overthrow Batista. So you had Richard Gibson and Robert Tabor, CIA assets, going down and meeting with Fidel Castro, coming back to the U.S., being the fronts for this organization, because they didn't really run the organization. The CIA ran the organization, right? So anyone who says that Oswald was a communist and that he handed out flyers for Fair Play for Cuba Committee, that was a CIA operation. He was a CIA operative the entire time. He was an FBI informant the entire time. The FBI had actually recruited him to inform on what these anti-Castro Cubans were doing, and he was actually trying to infiltrate some of these groups at the time when the assassination happened. So he was never really in or directly involved with any of the anti-Castro Cubans, but the other Oswald might have been, right? That's where the confusion comes into play. This is all spycraft stuff. So, but the Oswald that we know, who actually got killed by Jack Ruby, he was probably never involved with any of these groups because he was trying to infiltrate them, right? But they knew it because they had the other Oswald. So, and this is Richard Gibson and Robert Tabor. I mean, these two are the most American guys you're ever going to see working for the CIA, and yet they're the founders. I mean, this is just CIA nonsense. Okay. Now, this is not George Bush. This is one of the big ones. Everyone seems to think the guy leaning against the wall is George Bush. It's not George Bush. It's a guy named H.H. Davis. H.H. Davis was a detective, the Dallas sheriff. So that was a simple one. That's a quick one. We can move past this one. And all right. So where was George Bush? George Bush said that he was at a Kiwanis Club meeting. The thing is, there was no Kiwanis Club meeting that day. The meeting that he had was the night before in Dallas for the American Association of Oil Drilling Contractors, right? So he got his information mixed up when he told people where he was. But where was he? He was absolutely in Dallas because his wife actually wrote a book, and she talks about dropping off Mr. Zeppo, who is actually Tony Zoppi, Z-O-P-P-I. He was the owner of the Dallas, whatever the big newspaper there was. They were flying on his plane, and he basically, George Bush goes and drops her off at the beauty salon. He goes, I'm sure, to Dealey Plaza, and then the president gets killed. He goes back and picks her up. They drive back to the airport. Which might have been Redbird. There's a whole incident at Redbird Airport after the assassination. I haven't made the connection yet, but I'm close. And so they take off from there. And basically, it says right here in this letter that she had written was that they were circling the field when the second presidential plane took off, right? So then they got off at Love Field of the private plane, got onto a commercial flight, flew back to Houston. That's where George Bush was that day. Very close to proving that he was on the grassy knoll, not as a shooter, but was there. When I get that information, I'll definitely let you know. Okay, more disinformation. Beverly Oliver is not the babushka lady. She was 17 at the time and blonde. The babushka lady's in her late 30s, early 40s, and I have a pretty damn good suspect on who the babushka lady really is. I'm not ready to reveal that yet. I'll say this much, a friend of Ruth Payne, who also was lurking that day. All right, Oswald's three escapes. Let me go ahead and debunk all this stuff right here. The official story is that Oswald took a bus and a taxi after he shot the president. It would have been the first time in history anyone ever committed a capital crime and then escaped on public transportation. and then you have two witnesses who saw Oswald flee in a light green station wagon driven by a dark-skinned husky Latin who had been detained immediately after the assassination, but released because he didn't speak English. There's only two people that could possibly be, and I believe both of them kind of eliminate Oswald as having been the one who fled in that station wagon. The third one, you have Chief Curry, who in two different interviews said that Oswald was driven to the Texas Theater by taxi by a guy named Daryl Bo Click. I did a ton of research on who Bo Click was, and I finally figured out who it was. His name is Travy Bo Click. He was a Marine. He died in a mysterious plane crash in 1967. And that's pretty much all I know about him. He worked at the Dallas Transit Company, which ran the buses and the taxis, was not actually run by the city of Dallas. It was run by a couple of businessmen who were directly connected to Jack Ruby. Now, I'm going to talk about Oswald's bus ride real quick. I mean, honestly, I could spend 3 hours on the bus ride itself, but I'm going to try to get the pertinent points out very quickly. So the only evidence they actually had that he was on the bus that he fled in was the transfer ticket that they found in his shirt pocket. But the problem is he was arrested at the Texas Theater. They basically almost ripped his shirt off of him. It ripped buttons off. He fell on the ground. His elbows were skinned. They searched him when they put him in the car. Didn't find anything on him. Then mysteriously, 2 hours later, this bus transfer ticket appears in his pocket, and it's in mint condition. Not a wrinkle, a crease, a fold, nothing. It's in perfect condition after he just basically got his ass kicked by the cops. Does that make any sense whatsoever? None,
yeah.
Yeah, like the History Channel, I included this down here, because the History Channel, they did a repro of one for a special, and even they knew that it should have been wrinkled. You know, look at that picture. They're not dummies, right? The only people who are dummies here is us for ever having believed anything that the CIA or FBI ever told us. Right. So, and then you have problems with the witnesses. Like the witness on the bus was a woman named Mary Bledsoe, who coincidentally happened to be his previous landlord, where he had stayed at a month before. At a boarding house. And coincidentally, her son was in the Marines with Oswald. I mean, give me a break. She also let it slip to the cops that she had seen Oswald get on the bus that morning. Now, how could she have seen Oswald get on the bus that morning if he was living at North Beckley? Couldn't have. He had to have still been staying at her boarding house if she was able to see him get on the bus that morning, right? Everybody who Oswald came in contact with is connected to the CIA and Jack Ruby. And they were all in on it. This is like a big Truman Show, for real. Yeah, this is Mary Bledsoe. She says she was the former, she was the former landlady, but she also shares a cousin, a guy named Germany. His last name is Germany. He's her first cousin and the cousin of R.D. Matthews. R.D. Matthews was definitely in Dealey Plaza. He's connected to Las Vegas. He worked under Mo Dalitz and Louis McWillie. Louis McWillie was R.D. Matthews' boss, and Mo Dalitz was McWillie's boss. But R.D. Matthews recruited a bunch of guys to be in Dealey Plaza. Him and Jack Todd and Angelo Thomas Caston and a couple other people were in Dealey Plaza that day, stopped, detained, and arrested and let go, all giving fake names. I pretty much debunked all their fake names and know who's who based on some linguistic stuff, manner of speaking, things like that. So, but yeah, the whole bus ride thing never happened. Now, the taxi ride never happened either. He describes a person, this is William Wally. William Wally, he describes the person who got into his cab as having a shirt, a brown shirt with a silver stripe on it and some kind of jacket. And then he had a coat on over his jacket. But allegedly, Oswald just had a white t-shirt and a brown shirt, right? So it was definitely not Oswald who got in. And I believe I know who the person is that he dropped off. And I also believe that Oswald never lived at 1026 North Beckley, right? So the taxi driver, he never gave Oswald a ride anywhere. Okay, so this is Daryl Beauclick. There's not a lot of information on Daryl Beauclick, and I give a lot of credit to one of the forums who actually figured this out. His name's Travy Delano Beauclick. He was also a pilot. He was in the Marines. He died in a mysterious plane crash in 1967, and he's related to Bernice Click, who is a direct associate of Jack Ruby, who he'd been in contact with in the days before the assassination, right? So it's not a stretch to believe that the real way that Oswald got out of there was through Beauclick, who was definitely a contact of his. Now, the person who actually went to 1026 North Beckley, I believe, was Herbert Leon Lee. This guy's a real interesting guy. As you can tell here, this is the dates. They say that it was O.H. Lee who was staying at 1026 North Beckley, and that was an alias that Oswald was using. It absolutely was not. You had Herbert Leon Lee who stayed in room O, so it was O.H. Lee. And Herbert Leon Lee was contacted by the FBI. He admits he was staying there, and in his obituary, it says that he was a floor layer for 30 years before being picked up by some police department in his 50s in like Shreveport, Louisiana. So you have what they were doing on the fifth and sixth floor, the depository, was they were laying new floor. Right? A lot of the guys you'll see in Dealey Plaza have like chalk on them, like on their clothing. It's because that came from the laying the floor in the fifth and sixth floor of the depository. He was a floor layer for 30 years, right? And the guy who, William Wally, who said the person was in his cab, said that he had like this chalk or dust on his shirt, obviously because he was laying floor, right? So then you've got this guy who's laying the floor in the book depository, takes a cab to his place where he's living at 1026 North Beckley. The guy living there, his name is Herbert Leon Lee, and he happened to be a floor layer for 30 years. I mean, it's not too difficult to realize that it was probably Herbert Leon Lee who he gave the ride to.
Right.
All right, now let's get to J.D. Tippit. J.D. Tippit was shot by two people. This is pretty clear evidence. There is some shenanigans with the actual shells. Some people say that the shells were swapped out. Who knows? But the reality is three of these bullets have a rectangular imprint from a semi-automatic weapon because the hammer on that is round with a little rectangular piece on the side. And you can see that on three of these. And then the fourth in the upper right corner is totally round, and it's shot from a revolver, right? So this is pretty clear evidence that it was two different guns that fired the bullets that killed J.D. Tippit. Now, I believe the person who killed J.D. Tippit was Larry Crawford, and I believe that because he had a jacket that he disposed. They say it was Oswald's jacket, but inside the jacket, there was a dry cleaning tag. The dry cleaning tag led back to a dry cleaner in Detroit whose name was Earl Ruby, okay? So Earl Ruby and Larry Crawford knew each other. Obviously, Larry Crawford worked for Earl Ruby, but you never really hear about Earl Ruby having been in the story of JFK. And that's because I believe that Earl Ruby was using the alias of George Senator the entire time. you hear about Jack Ruby's gay roommate a lot, and his name was George Senator. But based on the research that I've done, I don't think George Senator was even in Dallas or had anything to do with the assassination. I believe he lived in New York the entire time, and that Earl Ruby was using his identity. I have a couple of reasons for believing that, and a couple things that confirm my suspicions, including photographs that are in the National Archives that label George Senator as Earl Ruby by mistake. But I don't think it's a mistake. So that's the shooting of J.D. Tippit right there. From here, I mean, I could go into like how Oswald was actually in the theater already. He was in the theater by 1:06. The story of him not buying a ticket is false. He entered the theater between 1 and 1:06, and he went up and we know this because he was seen by the guy who was at the time the manager, and he was working behind the candy counter. And so at one point, I'll go over what Oswald did. Oswald goes into the theater and he buys a ticket. He sits down, but he keeps getting up and moving. Witnesses inside the theater said he got up and moved at least 3 or 4 times. He ends up going and sitting next to a pregnant woman. He speaks to this pregnant woman for a couple minutes, and then both of them get up and leave to go to the lobby. The pregnant woman leaves, and he goes and buys popcorn. He gets his popcorn, and he goes back to his seat. And then after that, at 1:30, you have whoever the second person was who entered into the theater. It's either William Seymour or Larry Crawford. It's one of those two guys. I haven't quite figured out which one. Because at this point, you have these guys are interchangeable, right? They're at the assassination. They're both going to flee. So I haven't been able to really pin down which guy it was who went to the theater. So you have him. You know, the story is that he ducks into the front of that shoe store. And the manager of the shoe store thinks he's suspicious, so he calls the cops. Well, the manager of the shoe store is directly connected to two guys who were in the store with him. I don't want to go into too much detail about this because not many people have figured this out yet. But the two guys in the store with him worked for the CIA, and he probably worked for the CIA. And so, like I said, this is the Truman Show. Every single person you come in contact with had contact with either the mob, the CIA, or somebody. So that entire phone call about him having ducked into the shoe store and then going into the theater without buying a ticket, that is most likely false. But there was a second person who did actually do that, go into the theater without a ticket, and they went up to the balcony, right? There's a balcony up there. So eventually Oswald gets arrested out of the theater. A couple minutes later, a person is dragged out of the balcony and taken out the back door. Second person arrested out of the Texas theater. There was a witness in there who saw all this. And then as he's leaving, he's walking out. He sees a guy sitting in the back row of the theater. And he says he's wearing a dark suit and a hat. And he says to the guy, hey, man, you might want to get out of here. This place is crazy, or something along those lines. And he sees inside the guy's shirt, inside of his suit jacket, there's a revolver inside of his suit jacket. So many people think that it was Jack Ruby or Sam Ruby who was actually there in the theater also. That I haven't proven yet, but I can tell you with certainty there was somebody there with a suit and a gun in the back of the theater who was not a cop. So that's one of the many mysteries. If I were to actually take the time to solve every single one of these mysteries, I would be doing it for the rest of my life. I mean, the body of literature is so overwhelming. It's sometimes I'll sit down to do research and it's hard to know where to begin. So this is the jacket that was dropped. It's not Oswald's jacket. Oswald had two jackets. He had like a blue one and like a silver one. One of them was in the possession of Ruth Payne at the time, and the other one was found in the depository the next day by a guy named Ed Kaiser. Now, Ed Kaiser, that's a whole nother hallway of points I could bring up. We're going to have to pass on that. But the jacket that was found, this is most likely Larry Crawford's jacket or possibly Emilio Santana. So... okay, backyard photos. Those were fakes. There was a couple, Pat and Robert Hester, who basically worked for a photo development lab in Dallas. And that night, the night of the assassination, which is a day or two before they allegedly found them, they actually saw they found an FBI agent with color transparencies of the backyard photos that Robert processed that had no figure in the picture. So the backyard photo is definitely fake. Why this information hasn't come out, I really have no idea. So let's back up a little bit in Oswald's work history. He worked for a company called Jagger Stovall. Jagger Stovall was a CIA front company that basically they would get all the photographs from like the U-2 spy plane and really sensitive photographs. They were the ones developing it. Oswald worked there, and while he worked there, he wrote in his notes, micro dots. So micro dots are tiny photographs that'll fit under a postage stamp. So you can mail a letter with a photograph that's small enough, or it's a negative that would fit under a postage stamp. So then it could be mailed from wherever in the world and then developed when it got to where it was going. This was just more proof that Oswald was CIA and he wasn't just some schlep. Definitely not a communist. And photographic manipulation. So Jagger Stovall, 100% of the photographs that we've ever seen of Dealey Plaza or the JFK assassination all came out of Jagger Stovall. The FBI collected everything. If they found out you were in Dealey Plaza and took pictures, they went to your house, and if you didn't give them the pictures, they arrested you. They collected every photograph that was taken, period. And if you can look here, this is a very important picture. You got three people on the left who are obviously obfuscated. You've got two that have black circles just drawn over their faces. And then you got this one person right here that's dressed all in black, possibly a woman, and her face is melted off. And then on the right side over here, you have just a big black, like they just took a magic marker and just put some black magic marker there. So almost every photograph that you've seen has some form of manipulation on it. This person here in the black, this person is key. This person might even be the grassy knoll shooter. This person, there is mention of this person. I don't want to get into details, but there is a credible person who mentioned someone dressed all in black who got arrested in Dealey Plaza, looked like a ninja. And if you ask me, this person kind of looks like a ninja the way they're dressed. So this person definitely, probably one of the shooters, possibly the knoll shooter itself. Okay, so the next photographic manipulation, you got Abraham Zapruder, who may or may not have even filmed the Zapruder film. Like that thing, I have a picture of the ledge where he's supposed to be on, and it's definitely not him on it. So the face of his assistant is scratched out. If you look at it, you can tell it's distinctly scratched out. And why? Why would they do that if he actually was up there with her filming? His story about the Zapruder film doesn't really make any sense anyway. So next one, you got two people on the front of the school book depository. One face melted off, the one on the left just covered up. Now, the guy with the white shirt with the hands over the head, that I determined is a guy named Joe Molina. Joe Molina worked at the depository. He was investigated as one of the assassins. He's still one of the guys I really need to do some more research into. And, you know, it looks like the person in black there is holding something like a long and black in their hand. What it is, a broom, a rifle, who the hell knows? But there was definitely some photographic manipulation going on here. Another one with some photographic manipulation and some detail, the car in front of Kennedy actually hit the brakes. Before Kennedy was shot, the lead car actually almost came to a stop. And then if you actually look at how the cars proceeded, the limo went around the lead car, and then when they come out the other side, the lead car goes back around the limousine. So they did like a leapfrog kind of thing. Why? I have no idea. That I'll hopefully figure out one day. But here's more photographic manipulation in the Altgens photo. If you can see where the arrow is pointing, you've got a person's face in the crowd completely blacked out. Now, the funny thing is, when you look at the Towner film, the Towner film was filmed from one of the cars as it was going around the parade, one of the open car of one of the camera cars. That car shows that video, that image shows very different lineup of people. I mean, this Altgens photo might be a complete fake. It's possibly a complete fake. I can't emphasize enough. The photographic manipulation was so ever present. And if Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin, why would you have to do any of that stuff?
Right.
And here's another one, cropped images. You've got this photograph on the upper left, and then if you look at something like the Bell film, you can see people hanging out the window. Some people speculate they're holding rifles, but if you're a shooter, that's not how you shoot out a window. You shoot from a couple feet back so nobody can see in. But still, they cropped that out of many images of the assassination photographs and films. All right, next, let's get to the tramps. Okay, so the tramps that everyone thinks have been identified have not been identified. The tramps that they have identified as Gus Abrams, John Forrester Gedney, and Harold Doyle, and that they interviewed in the 90s, they did some real good shuffling of paperwork in order to come to the conclusion that these three guys were the tramps, because they're not. Those tramps were arrested about 12:35, almost immediately after the assassination. The group of tramps that we're familiar with, the ones in the picture here, they weren't arrested till after 2 p.m., almost 2:30. And the original tramps were arrested in a flatbed car. these tramps were pulled out of a grain car. They were seen by Lee Bowers, who was the towerman, hopping from car to car to car. And then when he stops the train, they go and they arrest these guys. They pull them out of a train full of grain. So anybody who says that they were one of the tramps, like Chauncey Holt, anybody tells a story that they were the tramps or know about the tramps and they don't mention the car full with grain, or they're just lying. So we have two sets of tramps. I'm pretty confident the tramps are Leo Masseri, a guy named Ralph Elmer Slafter, and the short guy is not some wicked assassin who killed Martin Luther King. He's probably a guy named Manuel Aguiar. I can show you my documentation on why I believe it's those people, but that would take way too much time for me to explain today. But I'm pretty sure I know exactly who they are. All right, assassin target practice. On November 20th, you have two different incidents within like an hour of each other. First, you have two women who worked nearby, and they saw two men passing a rifle back and forth outside the school book depository in the parking lot behind by the railroad tracks. That same day, you have two police officers who are seeing two guys point a rifle over the fence from the grassy knoll area as if they're going to shoot something. By the time they get over there, those guys are gone. This is all in the Dallas Police Department documents, the FBI documents. Somebody was out there, you know, scoping out the situation and seeing what they could do. And so what probably happened is they probably handed the rifle back and forth and then, just put it over the fence just to see what it would look like. Cops seen them, they come, and they are gone by the time the cops get there. So and just more damning evidence that Oswald had nothing to do with this. And that is it for my screen share.
That was very interesting. That's fantastic research. I mean, so much stuff that I've never heard before, and I don't think anyone's brought to the table before.
Nope, no one's brought this stuff. Well, here's the thing. A lot of this stuff has been ignored. The developments that I've made in regards to the skating rink and some of these identifications, nobody has. I've definitely made some original identifications of people in Dealey Plaza, some mob bosses. I've identified probably, I think I found Ted Shackley and George Joannidis in Dealey Plaza. I've identified a bunch of people who I'm pretty confident are who I think they are. Can I ever prove it definitively? No, and there'll always be people who say, no, you're wrong. But you know, when I show them the stack of documentation, they'll go, it's still not him, right? So there's way more. Like, this isn't even like a fraction of the stuff that I've uncovered in the past 6 months.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm sure you have plenty more that you could come back on and discuss with us at another time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this stuff connects to MK Ultra because you've got David Ferry and Bill DeMar and another guy who were hypnotists. You've got the Civil Air Patrol that Oswald and Ferry were in, which was actually a front for human trafficking, child trafficking. Connected, and it was also prostitution and heroin and gun smuggling. You've got Jack Ruby had a prostitution ring that overlapped with Bobby Baker's prostitution ring in Washington, D.C., and Bobby Baker's prostitution ring is directly connected to, I think her name is Lorraine Ramesh. She was a Russian spy that was banging John F. Kennedy, and John F. Kennedy was freaking out that it was going to come out that he was banging this Russian spy, and it was going to end his career and end everything. Right. So that's one of the speculative rumors of why he was killed, but not really. That goes back to the Otto Skorzeny connection, because Otto Skorzeny was directly connected to George DeMornshield and a whole network of people in Dallas. I mean, this thing is so deep. Most people would not even believe me if I told them.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like I said, I'm definitely going to have you back on. I'm sure there's all kind of rabbit holes we could go down with this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the things I recently discovered was that Clay Shaw, besides being, I mean, all these guys who we're talking about, they're all homosexual, involved in weird, kinky S&M stuff. But like Clay Shaw killed a guy. He was so deep into this S&M and hitting people with whips and spikes and stuff that somebody actually died in his house. But he knew the coroner. The coroner came, picked up the body, and the whole thing got swept under the rug. I mean, there's so much to this. It's just, it's unreal.
Wow. Well, is there any final conclusions or messages you want to leave us with before you head out tonight?
Yeah. You can't allow the minutia to affect the understanding of the big picture, right? Like if I never study another thing about Kennedy, I know that it came from Israel, it was facilitated by the CIA, and it was executed by the mafia. That's the big picture. And really, you don't really need to go any further than that. All of this little stuff really just backs up the main thesis. And that's pretty much it.
Very well said. Well, I want to thank you again for taking the time to share that with us, and we will definitely have to have you back on again.
All right, man. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
All right. You have a good night.